You know that we love our on-demand listeners here at Lutheran Public Radio. Now, if you've enjoyed listening to Issues Etc. in 2008, please consider making a year-end gift to help support this worldwide outreach. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can contribute by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and mail it to LPR Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. LPR Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us as we approach the end of 2008.
You're impossibly fast and strong. You gotta give me some answers.
I'd rather hear your theories.
I have considered radioactive spiders and kryptonite.
It's all superhero stuff, right? What if I'm not the hero? What if I'm the bad guy?
You know what you are. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No. This isn't real. This kind of stuff just doesn't exist.
It does in my world.
Well, it's a trailer from a very popular movie based upon a very popular series of books. If you haven't read them, I guarantee your teenage daughter or son or grandson or daughter has. Twilight is the movie and the book series. It's got vampires. It's got love. I heard someone say the other day that it's a billboard for abstinence. That's an interesting take. Kind of family values take on Twilight. We're going to be talking about the movie and the book series Twilight. Dr. Richard Stockwish is our guest. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Thursday afternoon. It is the 18th of December, our last live broadcast before the Christmas break. Now, if you have a question or a comment on the Twilight movie or the book series, give us a call, 1-877-623-6943-877-623-MYIE. We have an in-studio email address. It's talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Richard Stockwish is pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana, author of the blog Thinking Out Loud. Dr. Stockwish, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
Should Christian readers avoid Twilight?
Well, no, I don't think that would be necessary. I mean, I'm always kind of keen for parental oversight, and I think with younger children, adolescents, especially preteens, I think parents ought to be aware of what their children are reading and, if possible, read along with them. But there's nothing in these books that would cause me to say Christians ought to avoid them. I tend to be a little more open-minded, I suppose, than some folks. But there's both, I think there's a lot of redeeming qualities about these books, and there are some things that I would say raise a flag of caution, but nothing that would make me say, no, Christians should avoid these. I think there's a lot of Christians that have already read them and enjoyed them, and so I think it bears paying attention to them for that reason.
Somebody says, look, vampires. We're talking about, if this is the classic vampire of kind of the Halloween lore, we're talking about an undead individual who sucks human blood, and if the formula works, she makes more vampires that way. How could Christians read this?
Well, I mean, these are fictional concepts, and it's similar to some of the things I've talked about with the Harry Potter books. It's the literary device that Stephanie Meyer uses in this particular series. Her take on the whole vampire legend is actually pretty fascinating, because she borrows some of the classic images, but a number of the ones that pop into people's mind first and foremost, she dismisses as myth, even within the story. There's a little humor involved in that. What's kind of compelling in this regard is that the vampire, who is the main male character in the story, and his family have basically made a conscientious decision to not drink human blood. So they live off the blood of animals, even though it's not as satisfying, it's not as tasteful to them, but they have a conscience, and they make a deliberate choice not to kill human beings. So I mean, there's a sense in which the books do have a strong aim at making conscious decisions to avoid what is evil and to do what is good. And it's not theological necessarily. It's religious in a way. It has more to do with morality and ethics and with the author's own religious background, which is not Christianity but Mormonism. But in terms of the themes of right and wrong, good and bad, good and evil, the vampires, the main vampires in her books, are setting themselves against their own kind of supernatural world by making this decision, which most of the vampires think is just kind of crazy or intriguing. But that's a prominent theme underlying the books.
Tell us the story that we would find in the Twilight book, the series, but especially it's been adapted to a movie. What's the story?
Yeah, the first book is the one that was used for this movie, and I've seen the movie twice now. I went to see it on my own when I knew you guys were going to talk to me about this, and I took my wife to see it to get her reaction. And I can say more about that in a bit if you like, but the first book really is a romance for young adults, although young adults probably covers a pretty wide spectrum. These books appeal especially to young women, teenage girls, and young women in their 20s and 30s, from what I gather. And the first book really is a romance. It's about the main character, Bella, falling in love with this vampire boy, Edward. And the main focus of the book is on their love for each other, which I can see on the one hand why this appeals to young ladies. On the other hand, it's a bit frustrating to me, and perhaps this just shows my bias as a guy, but their relationship is basically about their relationship. There's not a lot that they do together. There's not sort of the underlying foundation of friendship that I think is important to healthy relationships, whether of the romantic variety or not. And that's something that's, I think, missing, especially in the first book. The main focus is on how madly in love they are with each other and how completely taken with each other they are. And it's almost like a competition, the old thing, well, I love you more, you know, and if you leave, I can't live without you. And that I find on the one hand a little bit tedious, and on the other hand, it is the one aspect of the book in particular that does trouble me a bit and raise some red flags for me. There's a point, and I honestly don't remember if this was in the first book or if it was in the second book or the third book. They all kind of blur together in my mind at this point, but where Bella essentially says that she would rather be damned than live without Edward. And given the sort of context and some of the scenario, that's not just rhetoric or hyperbole. She really, her whole life literally depends upon Edward and being together. And that kind of obsession blurs the distinctions between right and wrong and what truly is good and evil in a way that that's actually a far greater concern to me than the whole literary device of the vampires. Frankly, and that's the one big red flag that I have.
I was listening to a review, I believe, on National Public Radio, and because, of course, these things are a pop culture phenomenon. It's just
unbelievable. They're huge. They're just huge all over the world.
And the reviewer there said something, and I'd like to check it against your experience with the books and the film. They said, oddly enough, even though it's a kind of a vampire flick, the fact that the relationship between this young man who's a vampire and this young girl is so cautious, and that he is trying to do good in spite of kind of his nature. This reviewer saw it as a metaphor for abstinence. He said it's a pro-abstinence film.
I think that's a fair evaluation. In fact, from what I understand, as I said, Stephenie Meyer is a Mormon, and from what I've been able to gather just in reading various things about her, she takes her religion very seriously. In one interview, I don't remember, it might have been on Amazon.com or elsewhere, but she basically said the Book of Mormon was like the most fundamental book to her. And From what I understand, her publisher kind of pushed for her to have these two characters fornicate, and she refused. And that seems to come both from her religious convictions and also because it didn't really fit with what she was doing in the story. But I think it doesn't fit with what she's doing in the story precisely because she has some strong opinions about this. They do remain chaste up until they get married. And I suppose I'm giving away spoilers now, but in the fourth book, they do get married. And it's not until after that that they consummate their relationship physically. And this isn't just accidental to the storyline. This is already in the first book. This is kind of in view. There is something about the telling of this story. I don't know if erotic is too strong a word. There's certainly a sensual character to their relationship, which sort of heightens the fact that they don't fornicate. I mean, they resist that very deliberately. Edward does in particular. It's interesting because they do have an extended discussion at one point about virtue, because Bella actually is a bit more passionate and eager than Edward is, and he basically is protecting her virtue, and he's quite forthright about that. And
let's take a break right here, Dr. Stockwish. Okay. I want to come back to that. It's intriguing. We're talking about the Twilight series of books and the movie. What do you know about it? 1-877-623-6943. It's Thursday afternoon, the 18th of December, Issues Etc. Live for your phone calls and your email on the Twilight book series and movie. Dr. Richard Stockwish is our guest. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or email us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Your thoughts on Twilight after the break. When we come back, how else does the Mormon faith, apparently rather devout Mormon faith of the author of this series of books, Twilight, what else of it comes through in the books, if any? We'll be right back.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. on-demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio.
If you've enjoyed listening to Issues Etc. in 2008, please consider making a year-end gift to help support this worldwide outreach. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can contribute by check, make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio, and mail to LPR Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. LPR Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Thanks for your support as we approach the end of 2008.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A Word for Life.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Worldwide, 28% of pregnancies end in abortion each year. This means that for every 3 children born, 1 is also aborted. Though this number has been trending down slightly, more than 1 million children are killed in the womb each year in America alone. Lately, news outlets have reported that even some pro-lifers are tired of talking about abortion, a development they call fetus fatigue. But may we never grow weary of standing up for the unborn and of praying that our country would repent and acknowledge that every child, born or unborn, is a reward from God.
Are you pro-life? Then visit our website at sba-list.org and discover how you can make a difference. I'm Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. Thanks for taking a stand.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Richard Stockwish is our guest as we talk about Twilight, the movie and the book series. Everybody knows somebody who's read them. And, of course, they are huge. Not only the books, it sold, the numbers are mind-boggling. And then the movie has, of course, we know these things always spin off into movies. The movie has the potential to turn into 1, 2, and 3. It happened with other books of this nature. I want your thoughts. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, or email us talkback@issuesetc.org. Talkback@issuesetc.org. Before the break, you were talking about the nature of virtue and the fact that in the Twilight book, at least the first one, the one that people see in the film, there is a kind of more virtue displayed by the vampire character than by his counterpart. Pick up where you left off.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's as prominent in the first book as it comes in the second and especially the third, where their relationship has developed considerably, and they're anticipating a point at which Bella will become a vampire also, and she's sort of eager to consummate their relationship before that change occurs, and Edward insists that they're not going to consummate their relationship until they get married, and he really doesn't want her to become a vampire because he's very afraid that it's going to destroy her soul, and he wants to protect her. I mean, he's really driven. He lives to protect her, and he loves her passionately, but virtuously. I mean, there is a sense in which this is one of the underlying currents in all of the books. Now, Bella herself, I think, is shown as, in terms of civil righteousness, in terms of life in the world, in terms of compassion for the neighbor, patience and courage and so forth, she demonstrates those kind of virtues herself. I mean, what's in some respects fascinating about these books is they're set within the context of teenage life within a public high school, and you don't have the sorts of things that usually dominate that kind of setting and context. There's not the promiscuity, at least it's not written into the books anywhere. You don't have the drinking and the drugs and so forth. There clearly is a kind of baseline sense of right and wrong. And so I think this is where the author's morality and ethics certainly do come into play. And her religious beliefs, although they're not Christian, they do have an ethical sort of foundation. The soteriology in the books, that is to say, any sense of salvation is clearly works righteousness-based. There's this idea that basically good people are going to go to heaven or going to live after death or whatever that's going to look like. And that stems, you know, into other interesting conversations. Edward is convinced that he has lost his soul by the fact that he's a vampire. His father in the family believes that they do have a soul and that there is a God and that there's some kind of reward for those who are intent upon doing good. So, I mean, to the extent that there's any kind of soteriology in these books, any sense of salvation, it's definitely works-based. It's not Christological. And so that's something that obviously a Christian needs to be on guard against. But that's not the prominent theme. I mean, you do have these, for lack of a better term, you have family values that permeate the books. There's an emphasis on how this family of vampires, because of their conscientious choice not to kill human beings, but to live off the blood of animals, they don't have the aggression among them that most vampires do. They actually have bonds of love that are considerably stronger than the sorts of bonds that other vampires develop out of fear or power alliances. And so there's set forth the idea of family as a fundamental sort of unit that has a strength that is rooted in love, which is finally superior to the power-grabbing and fear-mongering that you find among most of the vampire community. And that's kind of intriguing to me. I noticed that during your break you had one of your spots on the pro-life effort to oppose abortion. And that's interesting, too, because that comes into play after Bella and Edward get married. Surprisingly, they conceive a child, and nobody saw this coming. But there are dangers involved because the child is half human, half vampire, and actually the entire pregnancy lasts only a month, and the fetus is developing at this alarming rate and incredibly strong and has the kind of imperviousness of a vampire. And so basically, if Bella carries this baby to term, it's going to kill her, or in all likelihood it will. And so the family and everyone is basically intent on, basically aborting this fetus, not because they're interested in destroying life, but because they don't know what the thing is going to be, and they're certain it's going to kill Bella. Bella, on the other hand, loves this child and refuses absolutely for them to harm it. And so there's this very interesting dynamic, because it sets up a scenario in which this married woman is having a child and is likely to die by carrying it to term, and yet she chooses to go ahead and do that. And they do manage to prevent her from dying, because what they do basically is turn her then into a vampire immediately after giving birth. But she's basically willing to take the risk and make whatever sacrifice, and she's confident that she's going to live through it. But it is interesting that you have these themes, these family value kind of themes that run through the books. And as one reviewer noted, every time she's faced with this kind of choice, or every time she and Edward are faced with this kind of choice, they make the right decision, the ethical decision, the moral decision. And that is a prominent aspect of these books. I don't think it's that aspect that makes them so astonishingly popular. From what I gather, the thing that makes these books so popular among young women, which is the predominant audience or readership, is Edward. I mean, when I've encountered young women who have read these books, I've just asked, what is it about these books that appeal to you? And every single time, almost without exception, it's Edward.
This is very interesting, because that leads to the second of two questions I've got for you here, because you talked about your wife's reaction to all of this. This email comes from Jim in Indiana with a simple question.
Okay.
I have a 12-year-old nephew who wants to go see Twilight. Any thoughts?
I think it would be okay, especially if he's not one who's easily spooked or frightened. The movie is not, it's not a horror movie. I don't think it's an exceptionally good movie. It's mildly entertaining, and it's fairly well done. There's not the kind of, there's not the promiscuity. There's not bad language. There is some violence, but it's as you would imagine, but it's not over the top. So I think 12 is probably kind of on the borderline with what I would recommend. But if there's a responsible adult coming along, and if the parents are approving of this sort of thing, I wouldn't warn a person against it. I think there has to be parental discretion and good judgment involved. But the movie is not offensive, I don't believe. My wife found it entertaining. I think she enjoyed seeing it. It's not a great movie. I don't think it ought to win awards. The book doesn't translate well into a movie, in my opinion. I've seen some people say that it does, but the strength of the book, the strength of the author, especially in the first book, is her ability to describe, sometimes at great length, the inner thoughts and the emotions of the main character, Bella. And I think this is part of what appeals to the ladies as well, to the young women who read these books, is there's a dwelling upon and a savoring of the emotions and the inner thought processes that looks at things from every angle and wonders about things and really mulls over the relationship. So that doesn't translate well into a movie unless you have really consummate actors who are able to pull that off, and I don't think they do it myself.
Folks, we've posted a link to Dr. Richard Stuckwish's blog under the on-demand page of our website. His blog is called Thinking Out Loud. Our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Dr. Richard Stuckwish is pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana, author of the blog Thinking Out Loud. Read some more there, issuesetc.org, and click on demand. You'll find a link right there. Richard, thank you for being our guest.
It's always my pleasure, Don.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll continue our series, an Advent series, on the Advent O Antiphons, those ancient hymns of the church, very short as they are, that all extol Christ in Old Testament terms and drive us forward to the great antiphon, O Come, Emmanuel. Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest. Who can explain the wildfire of pop culture phenomena? no one can. Although when we see someone tap into it, boy, do they tap into it. And this is another one of them. How do we always, as Christians, proceed into pop culture? Cautiously. We need not fear culture. Remember, we are in the world, but not of the world. We need not fear it. And we don't need to walk around on eggshells as though we're afraid to get our hands dirty. What do? We engage it. We look it in the eye to see what it is, and then we always evaluate it in light of God's clear word. Not so much as to pass judgment on a film, this is good, this is bad. Those things, of course, are quite clear from God's word. It doesn't take a keen theological mind to come up with a judgment like that. But what is this? What is the worldview of a film like this saying to our young people? And what do we need to say in response to it, to those same young people? I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow, and thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.